This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Movie and TV adaptations of Sense and Sensibility, Emma, Persuasion, and Pride and Prejudice have revived interest in the writer Jane Austen. Austen lived from 1775 to 1817. Through the centuries, her readers have wondered how a single woman with little money, facing the gender restrictions of her time, managed to write such insightful and witty novels about love, class, and social life. Claire Tomlin tries to answer that in her new biography of Jane Austen. Tomlin is the author of an earlier biography of 18th-century feminist Mary Wollstonecraft. The Austen biography begins with a quote from Austen's great-nephews, who said the uneventful nature of the author's life has been a good deal exaggerated. Tomlin agrees. She says Austen's life was full of dramas, and they reflected in her novels.
We have Sense and Sensibility, which, as I see it, is really a debate. It's a novel about how people should behave. Of course, it's presented through the lives of young women, but essentially it is a debate that went on with considerable ferocity in the 1790s when it was written, about whether the correct way to behave was to conceal your emotions, to tell social lies, to protect yourself by behaving very conventionally, or whether it wasn't better to show your emotions, to be open, to be frank, to be free, as Marianne is. And it explores the effects of these two sorts of behaviour. And it seems to me that Jane Austen starts by somewhat endorsing one code of behaviour, the conventional one, and in fact becomes quite uncertain and somewhat changes her attitude and really comes round in many ways much more to the radical behaviour of Marianne. She gives her love to Marianne, I feel.
In Sense and Sensibility, that contrast between two different views, one the view of like discretion and rationality and the social code versus freedom and truth-telling and instinct, those two differences were represented in the sensibilities of two different sisters. Do you think that there was a conflict within Austen herself that represented these two different points of view?
I think it's certainly possible to believe that. The book was being written during the period when we know she was in love with the glamorous young Irishman stranger who arrived in Hampshire, Tom Lefroy. And we know that he was in love with her too, and that the incipient love affair was swiftly aborted by Lefroy's family. And we know from Jane Austen's first surviving letter that she exposed herself to comment, that she let her feelings show, that people were talking about this, and that she felt humiliated and she sorrowed for several years afterwards. So I think, although I'm always chary about feeling there's any biographical, so about suggesting there's any biographical element, I think there is some element there. And she gives some very sharp remarks to Marianne, who puts down some of her crasser, older male neighbours, which you can well imagine coming from the lips of Jane Austen, who had a very sharp pen and, one presumes, tongue at times.
Now, do you think this was the only time that she was in love?
Well, there is so much mist and so much uncertainty about the other alleged episodes of love. Her sister Cassandra, long after Jane Austen's death, remembered a possible love affair that took place on the Devon coast. But since the only evidence we have is Cassandra's misty memory, I think it would be rash to make too much of that. We do know, of course, that she had a proposal of marriage 7 years after the love affair with Tom Lefroy, and that is very interesting and very moving, because in her brief episode with Tom Lefroy, there was a very important dance where they had a lot of fun together and made a spectacle of themselves by sitting out together, and that dance took place at a neighbour's rather grand house called Manydown, and it was the son of that house, Manydown, Harris Bigwither, preposterous name, but a real one, who proposed to Jane Austen in Manydown House 7 years later. And she accepted his proposal. And the next morning, she told him she had to change her mind. She was very mortified. She was very upset. And it is a weird episode because he was the brother of her great friends. He would become the owner of an estate in Hampshire, and she loved living in Hampshire. And had she married him, he would have given her all the things girls at that time were brought up to think mattered. Status, money, children, the ability to help her old mother, her unmarried sister, and probably her many brothers, who some of them could do with a bit of a leg up in their careers in the Navy, for instance. So her turning down this really very suitable proposal of marriage is a real turning point in her life. I think we have to assume she was not in love with Harris. And I think we may also think she had begun to think that there were more interesting things in life for her than marriage.
But as you say, by turning down this proposal, she turned down the security that a man with an estate could provide. And that left her dependent on her family.
Yes, and she was very poor. Her poverty can hardly be exaggerated. She had, I think, two legacies in the early part of her life of £50 each. And apart from that, until she was in her 30s, she depended on whatever pocket money her parents or her brothers could give her.
Who did she live with over the years, and how was she treated?
She was born into a large family. She was the seventh child of a clergyman, George Austin, and his wife, Cassandra. And they were both very clever, very interesting, very remarkable people. Her father had been an orphan and a scholarship boy and had made his way. Her mother came of a grander family. But when they married, they had very little, and they settled in a pretty remote parsonage, which was called a living when you were a clergyman in the 18th century. But it was a poor living, and her father, in fact, had to earn most of his money to keep his children by farming, by really farming commercially. He was very interested in beef and hops and wheat and prices of the crops. Even that wasn't enough. He had to run a boys' school in his house. He had to take in boy boarders whom he taught with his own sons. So Jane Austen was born into this busy boys' school. A very striking event in her childhood was that her mother, with all her children as far as we know, fed them at the breast for a few months and then put them out into the village to be reared. So Jane Austen, like her brothers and sisters, was sent away at a few months into the labourers' cottages. We don't even know the names of the families the children were put into. That then, again, when she was seven, she was sent away from her family to boarding school, and she fell very ill. She nearly died. She came back. She was sent away again. So she had the series of, I think, painful episodes in her infancy and in her childhood, which must have been both difficult to deal with, and also perhaps, I think, the school episodes may have stimulated her imagination, stimulated her interest in reading and writing.
Did the members of Jane Austen's family respect her as a writer and appreciate the gifts that she had?
She was much loved in her family. Her eldest brother, James, who became a country clergyman, really thought of himself as the writer of the family, I think. And there was a little tension between James and Jane. I think his nose was probably a bit put out of joint when he found that his younger sister was so much more a successful writer than he was. But her brother Henry greatly valued her writing and helped to get her work published, and obviously was a great believer in her talent. Curiously, he almost certainly composed the epitaph on her tombstone in Winchester Cathedral, and he doesn't mention that she was a writer. And people have shaken their fingers at him. But he did actually, in obituary notices in the newspapers, talk about her books. Her books, as everyone knows, were published anonymously. Her name was not put upon them. And she was shy, and she protected her privacy.
Was her name not put on the books because she was a woman or because she was shy? I mean, what was the reason why they were published anonymously?
I think it was her choice. There's evidence from other women writers of that period that they just felt it would be too much to be exposed to public attention, that he didn't want to appear to be boastful. I mean, it's very fascinating. Her first book, Sense and Sensibility, the first to be published, is by a lady. Pride and Prejudice says, by the author of Sense and Sensibility. Mansfield Park says, by the author of Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice. And so it goes on. And even the two that were published posthumously still do not have her name on them.
How rare was it for a woman novelist to be published in the late 1700s and early 1800s when she was writing?
Well, not as rare as all that. It's a very interesting statistic. I think if you go through the 18th century, the publication of work by women increases in every decade. And in fact, 1775, when Jane Austen was born, was a very good time for an aspiring woman writer to be born. Publishers had realised that not only were women capable of writing very well, we'd had, of course, Fanny Burney as the great success, but there was a considerable market among women readers. So you get something very interesting happening economically. I mean, one can think at once of contemporaries, Anne Radcliffe, Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Hayes, Elizabeth Fenwick, Susan Ferrier. There really was a considerable body of serious women novelists. And, of course, there were a lot of sort of junk women novelists, too, who were writing for the circulating library trade. It was a favourable time.
Claire Tomlin, you have written an earlier book on Mary Wollstonecraft, the author of The Vindication of the Rights of Women, which was published in 1792. So you know a lot about the feminist issues of the time in which Jane Austen lived. How much was Jane Austen involved in feminist issues? What did she have a stand on them?
Well, Jane Austen remains very silent on some subjects, or at any rate, whatever papers of hers survive are silent. But I don't think you can read her novels without a very strong sense that by putting young women as the moral and intellectual centres of her stories, she rated them very highly. And in fact, she presents them very often as having finer reactions, finer sensibilities, quicker wits than the men around them. I don't think one can doubt, and you've had many English and American scholars have discussed this, and I would agree with them that there is a clear feeling that feminism, though the word didn't exist, was present in Jane Austen's consciousness and favourably present.
What were the women's issues of the time that were being debated?
Well, Mary Wollstonecraft really laid out for the first time the claim that it would be better for the whole of society if women had the same education as men, if they had the same professional opportunities, if they had the same legal status. And she even sketches in the idea that she might discuss their political situation, though she says, this is all Mary Wollstonecraft, that since so many men didn't have the vote at that time, it was a bit early to be thinking of women. So she really spelt out this programme, and she also wrote about marriage, and she suggested that in some circumstances marriage could be a form of prostitution and that it would be much better if marriage were established on a different basis. These were the main issues being discussed.
My guest is Claire Tomlin, author of a new biography of Jane Austen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Claire Tomlin, author of a new biography of Jane Austen. Jane Austen has been described with that, I think, awful word, spinster. And I'm wondering if you think that she was proud of the independent life that she chose or whether she felt diminished by her status as a spinster or a single woman.
She probably went through a period of adjustment when she had to adjust to the fact that she was not going to marry, that she was not going to have those wonderful things, a loving husband, children. And you see her becoming, instead, a very, very good aunt, and she was an excellent aunt. Her sister Cassandra spoke to one of her nieces, again, after Jane Austen's death, and said that there had been letters by Jane Austen in which, I think Cassandra uses the word, in which she triumphed over her married sisters. Now, this is towards the end of her life. when Jane Austen, the implication is that she saw the benefits for her as a writer, as an independent woman, of not being tied by childbearing. We know she used the phrase poor animal about her niece Anna, who was perpetually pregnant. And she certainly had the example of many of her sisters-in-law who bore babies year after year after year, and in some cases died of too much childbearing. So I think you have to see Jane's life progressing from being a young girl who was, of course, interested in love and who, of course, hoped to marry. And then when both she and her sister's fiancé died, and Cassandra would never then look at another man, they settled into this, in some ways, sad partnership of sisters. And then Jane developed her talent, and then it flowered when she began to publish and she began to make money, and this great burst of writing in her 30s, the end of her life. And I think by then she was perfectly happy not to be married.
You mentioned early on that the stereotype of Jane Austen is that she led this unruffled life, and isn't it amazing she was able to write such good books when her life was so uneventful? But you think that there were many dramas that shaped her life. Tell us about one of the dramas that you haven't yet mentioned.
Well, I've tried to sketch in what I see as the crucial drama of her childhood, which I think these perpetual exiles from home which were imposed on her, what I speculate in my book is that they may have made her prone to depression. Now, there is a mystery in Jane Austen's life. The mystery is that she wrote from her early teens to the age of 25, and she was enormously productive and produced already works of genius. And then she is silent for about 9 years. And then she starts writing again, has this second burst. And one of the questions I put myself when I was working on my research for this book was, how can we account for this mystery? And the answer I offer is that she did indeed go through a period of acute depression and writer's block. And I speculate that when her parents decided that the whole family was to leave the home in which she'd grown up and in which she had learnt to write and in which she had established a good writing pattern, she was quite powerless to do anything but accept her parents' diktat. But all the evidence is that she then became acutely depressed. They moved to Bath, and the few letters that survive are the letters of a depressed person. She says how she cannot like people, how she detests the social life. In a way, this is a circular argument of mine, because the fact that she did fall silent for this period, she had one go at writing a novel. She wrote a fragment called The Watsons, and then she gave it up. The fact that she was silent seems to me to indicate depression.
What are some of the difficulties that Jane Austen posed to you as a biographer?
The difficulty of writing about a genius, because there is something unknowable, I think, in the end, about a Mozart, a Jane Austen. Something mysterious has happened. You can say she had this very clever father who was very supportive. She had a mother who wrote, her mother wrote very good poetry. She had a very good atmosphere of access to books. She read, and one can trace what she read and talk about that. And one can point to the other members of her family and their abilities. But in the end, you cannot account for it. You cannot say why this one person turned out to be a genius as she did. And I particularly enjoyed writing about her writing, about her novels. In a sense, I felt I could be closer to her in considering her novels than I could be in considering her letters. That was a difficulty in writing about her, the letters. They are the letters of a very defended person. Jane Austen had a shell, a protective shell over her, which I think may have been something to do with her childhood, the difficulties, the pains of her childhood. She does not offer herself to you when you read her letters, as romantic writers do. Her letters were not written for publication. They were not intended for other eyes than those of their recipients.
Do you see Jane Austen's novels not only as great works of literature, but important documents in women's history?
That's how I first approached them, I suppose, really. When I, apart from reading them as a girl for pleasure, when I began researching Mary Wollstonecraft, I turned to them for evidence of attitudes in the period. Yes, I think they are. You have to be cautious about using fiction like that, but I think they are generally accepted by historians as giving very good evidence of the attitudes of the time.
Well, Claire Tomalin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I much enjoyed talking to you.
Claire Tomalin is the author of a new biography of Jane Austen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.